they may try to undertake to get JCPOA back on track.
And very briefly here, John, does this act of terror constitute provocation?
It's a massive provocation, and it's designed to be one. And it does place the Iranian government in the invidious position of choosing whether to undertake immediate retaliation, which is entirely justified in doing, or to play the longer game, knowing that this could well be, as Mr. Rouhani rightly points out, a trap being set by the Israelis and by the Trump administration before it departs the stage.
Wise counsel, as always, thank you very much, John White. Now we move on to some other news here coming out of Germany, because at least two people have been killed and many more injured when a car ploughed into civilians in the pedestrian area of the German city Trier earlier today. Eyewitness testimonies captured by local news outlets just moments after the crash have reportedly stated that passers-by flooded into nearby shops as the speeding car drove into crowds of people. Some have also claimed to have seen a pram being flung into the sky and seeing at least 30 people laying motionless on the streets. According to police, the suspect, a 51-year-old driver who resides within the Trier district, has been arrested, and the large vehicle he was driving has been seized pending further investigations. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has voiced growing security concerns over China's global rise at a meeting of the military alliance's foreign ministers.
China is not our adversary. Its rise presents an important opportunity for our economies and trade. We need to engage with China on issues such as arms control and climate change. But there are also important challenges to our security.
The comments will not have gone unnoticed in Beijing and would be seen as a continuation of the increasingly confrontational rhetoric the West has taken in regards to China. This following similar statements from the Trump administration and its European allies. As the UK prepares to exit its second national COVID-19 lockdown, all hopes seem to be pinned on a vaccine to ward off another and perhaps bring life back to some semblance of normality. As the COVID-19 death toll rises to more than 1.4 million annual across the globe, governments are fast-tracking the approval of various vaccines, and millions of doses are on the verge of being shipped across the planet. However, one of the challenges of mass immunization is convincing people the vaccine is safe, and the speed with which these ones are hitting the shelves could be a source of concern, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
Despite working at breakneck speed, the makers of the COVID-19 vaccines, now on the verge of being rolled out, insist no corners have been cut. Biotech company Moderna has applied for US and European emergency authorization for its vaccine, which it claims to be 94.1% effective with no serious safety concerns. Meanwhile, United Airlines are getting ready to kickstart a global supply and distribution network for Pfizer's vaccine. Governments everywhere are trying to secure their share to kickstart their economies.
We have every reason now to be very hopeful that these vaccines really will turn the tide in the struggle against the disease and unlock not just this country, but unlock the whole of the world and give people finally a sense of relief.
And as we set out this weekend, we've secured 2 million further doses, meaning that we in the UK now have access to a total of 357 million doses of seven different vaccines.
A mass inoculation program is expected to begin in late December, and more than 80% need to be vaccinated for the global initiative to succeed.
The challenges of mass distribution are immense. Some of those challenges are convincing people that the vaccine is necessary and safe, because this has happened before and things have gone wrong.
In 2009, a British company developed a swine flu vaccine. It was approved by the European Medicines Agency for use across the EU, but following a widespread vaccination campaign, 1,800 people, primarily children and young adults under 30, developed debilitating narcolepsy that causes excessive and often uncontrollable drowsiness. So is this happening too fast?
Apparently the MHRA, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority in this country, has put out a tender which was put out through the EU. I think that's how it got picked up into the news. But this tender is for an artificial intelligence system, which they are saying is necessary to spend public money on that because there are going to be a very high level of adverse events. Now, we obviously have had vaccination in this country for a very long time, mass vaccination programs on a routine basis. So that's quite surprising, because we've got all of these other vaccines with a system which copes with their adverse events, but apparently now we need an entire new standalone system because the level of adverse events expected are going to be kind of off the scale of what our existing systems can handle.
Children will not be immunised, but the British government has not ruled out making the vaccines compulsory for adults. Westminster is mulling ways to incentivise getting the jab first. People may need an immunity passport or QR code on their phone to attend football matches, the theatre and other events like the Tokyo Olympics. Qantas Airlines have already announced that proof that you've been vaccinated will be compulsory on its flights. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With big differences still to be bridged on state aid and fishing, Britain and the European Union have warned each other that time is running out to reach a Brexit trade deal. The United Kingdom will completely sever ties with the European Union on the 31st of December, when a transition period of informal membership ends. This comes as massive divergences on fisheries and trade disputes still persist. Speaking on the EU-UK Brexit tensions, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has stated that many EU member nations were, quote, losing patience. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who's also tackling the worst official European COVID-19 death toll, has previously stated that a deal would be preferable for Britain, but the UK would be prepared for a no-deal Brexit in any event. Well, Jonathan Fryer, the author and commentator, is with us for this one. And, Jonathan, will we get a deal? It seems this week is as late as we can push things.
Well, despite the rather fraught nature of the stop-start negotiations in the last few days, I'm actually feeling a little more confident that there will be a deal after all. Opposition parties in Parliament have started debate or discussing whether they're going to vote for it or against it or abstain, even though they don't have a text in front of them. And both sides in the talks have said they're prepared to talk right through this week, into the weekend, even beyond if necessary, because they really do want to try and find a deal. But that doesn't mean they necessarily will be able to overcome all of the outstanding issues.
Well, we've had Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking before about, you know, it being okay without a deal. Chancellor Angela Merkel is now saying that some EU leaders are losing patience. Is Britain going to just continue holding its bluff, holding its line clear here?
Well, I think the frustration felt by the EU27 leaders is very understandable, because whereas Michel Barnier, the EU negotiator, has carried out his side of the bargain in a very civilised, calm manner, the British side has been really quite aggressive, including from the Prime Minister, and have accused the Europeans of being the obstacle in the way of a deal, which is frankly not an objective appraisal of the current situation. And let's face it, the EU27 don't want Brexit. They never did. And several of the member countries, not least Ireland, are really going to suffer economically if indeed it goes ahead, and especially if it's a no-deal Brexit.
Well, I'm not asking you to be a betting man here, Jonathan, but what do you say are the chances of a no-deal at this stage, and where would that leave the Conservative Party going forward?
Well, I think it's probably now about 50-50, which is better than a couple of weeks ago. But as far as the Conservative Party is concerned, they will probably get a hit in the opinion polls early next year. But we have to remember they've got a majority of 80 in Parliament, so pretty safe. And they don't have to have another general election for another 4 years if they want. So Boris Johnson has time to ride this out, though rumours have it that he actually would quite like to step down early in the new year and hand the poison chalice over to somebody else.
Well, perhaps he can hold counsel with David Cameron and how that left his political career. Jonathan, thank you so very much. To some other news now, because as you might recall, over the summer, huge Black Lives Matter protests were held across the United States and all over the world in solidarity with Black Americans who are facing racial injustice. But in those subsequent months, have the words Black Lives Matter come to mean something entirely different? Well, this is the question Richard Sedan is asking in this edition of Cut to the Chase.
Over the summer of 2020, Black Lives Matter protests erupted over the US and around the world following the death of George Floyd. Anti-black racism and police violence in the US had restarted a new wave of protests, which first started in 2015 in Ferguson, following the killing of 18-year-old Mike Brown, a black man, by a white police officer, Darren Wilson. Fast forward to 2020, and this time millions upon millions around the world marched in solidarity with black Americans, causing the whole world to side-eye America. This global attention became concerning to the powers that be, and so the slogan Black Lives Matter began to be attacked to divert focus away from why the protest began, which is racial injustice in America, which has existed as long as the country has.
Black Lives Matter is now more popular than the President of the United States.
Black Lives Matter is killing Americans.
So what do I think those riots are? I think the depravity. I think they're thugs.
Right-wing media began intentionally using the term Black Lives Matter without distinguishing between those at the protests and Black Lives Matter, the organization. With no distinction made, criticisms of Black Lives Matter, the organization, de facto became attacks on all black people, in much the same way as the phrases thug, calls for law and order, gang culture had become the codified language of the white media to describe black people without doing it directly, reinforcing racist stereotypes already deeply rooted in America. This linguistic trick of European colonialism isn't just found in America. We see these subtle forms of racism in the UK media too, with phrases like knife crime, gang culture, and so-called black-on-black crime routinely peddled by the racist press. Using the term Black Lives Matter to simply mean black people is another tactic. Next came the claim that George Soros, rather than the continual killing of black people in America, was somehow the sole cause of the Black Lives Matter protests. While Soros contributed money to Black Lives Matter, the organization, neither the organization nor Soros are behind the millions of people rallying for justice for black people. Again, the sole cause is systemic racial injustice and police killings, something white America and the media wants you to forget. Remember, the police in America were literally formed from slave-catching gangs and still exist to this day to maintain the racial hierarchy in America. The precedent of giving white people like Soros the credit for things done by black people is not a new trick. White people are given the credit for ending slavery, apparently discovering Africa and America, where black people had already traveled to, while telling us that aliens built the pyramids and that Jesus looked like Brad Pitt. Trust me when I say this, George Soros isn't responsible for the protests in the United States. Also not responsible for the Black Lives Matter protests are so-called trained Marxists. While the founders of the Black Lives Matter organization in the US might identify as such, only a tiny minority of the many millions around the world who identify with the slogan Black Lives Matter are Marxist. All of these excuses are commonplace in the news. What you will never hear is the very blunt reality and cause of the protests. Ongoing continued racism in the US, massive levels of lethal violence towards the black community from policing and white terror groups the police often turned a blind eye to. Systemic racism at the heart of the United States, which has existed for more than 400 years, is not a broken system. It's the system working as it was meant and designed to do so. Those who benefit from this system will tell you anything to make you believe black protests are a conspiracy. There is no conspiracy. Systemic racism as a system of power in America is working as it was meant to. Those who benefit from it want to keep it that way. So, the next time you hear someone using the term Black Lives Matter without defining it, you can be sure that they simply mean all black people, and you know what they really mean.
So troubles down under as tensions brew between Australia and China. You can tell me all about it, Robert Inlakesh.
Well, if you've been paying attention to the media in recent weeks and around a month ago, we saw a story emerge because of leaked documents out of the Australian military, which pointed out that Australian Special Forces teams had essentially killed 40 Afghan civilians in the most brutal ways you could imagine. But the Australian media is not mad so much about that. The Australian media is mad about the fact that China, in fact, a Chinese diplomat tweeted a cartoon which was created which depicted an Australian soldier killing an Afghan child. This is what the Australian Prime Minister had to say about this.
The Chinese government should be totally ashamed of this post. It diminishes them in the world's eyes. I want to make a couple of points about this. Australia is seeking an apology from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs from the Chinese government for this outrageous post.
So no ability to take any criticism we see there from the Australian side, trying to say that this was a doctored photo when clearly it was a cartoon. Anyone who looks at it can see that it's a cartoon. And this is criticism from a foreign government. And it doesn't seem that the Australian media as well, when we look at the Australian media and the way they've reacted to these two stories, they've went absolutely irate when it comes to this tweet. Which came out just a few days ago. But when it comes to the claims of their soldiers massacring Afghan civilians just for the fun of it, that seemed to be not quite as offensive to them, and they didn't really...
So let me
really
see if I get this right, Rob. It's not so much the claims that Australian troops were committing extrajudicial killings here in perhaps a conflict they have no business being in, but it's the fact that a Chinese diplomat flag this up in a cartoon. Am I missing a link here?
No, that's exactly what's happening here. I mean, even when you look at the case of these Australian soldiers, they've sent them notices, which they have 2 weeks to respond to. I believe 13 of them, these special forces people, were sent these notices. Essentially, they're saying that they'll be fired, but it will take years and years for it to even come to court. They probably will not be imprisoned for their crimes against humanity, which were committed in Afghanistan. No reconsidering of their role in Afghanistan, despite the fact that they've been there for 19 years and there's no reason for them being there. But they're just absolutely irate when it comes to these a depiction, I believe an accurate depiction, of what was happening in Afghanistan. So this is how they deal with foreign criticism. And it's funny that the Chinese said, because there's an ongoing sort of dispute between Australia and China, they said that they'll turn Australia into the white trash of Asia, which seems to be the way that they're reacting here, just thinking that they are the superpower behaving like it and trying to tell the Chinese that they can't criticize Australia when Australia is frequently criticizing China, and China has not behaved in this way.
Right. The online reaction to this should be interesting.
The first tweet we've got here is from Syrian Girl on Twitter. She says, "The image China tweeted about Australia isn't fake or doctored because it's a depiction. They're not saying this is an actual photo. What they're what's actually fake is babies in incubators, children overboard, Syrian chemical weapon attacks. What's real is Australian soldiers shot civilians." We got another one here as well who says, "A reasonable summation of the pic is that it is graphic but accurate in its depiction. We are getting the outrage. The outrage is not because Australians did commit such heinous murders, but because they are being exposed internationally for it."
And this is, very briefly, Robert, a rather new phenomenon. We hadn't really heard much about Australia's behavior and its role in Afghanistan.
No, we hadn't up until this point. We heard quite a bit about British troops and what they'd done. But Australians have killed, and there's various human rights groups which have reported on this, have killed a lot of Afghan civilians, hundreds of them, in collateral damage due to their airstrikes that they've committed.
All right. We leave it and obviously continue to watch that story. Robert Inlakesh, thank you. And, of course, thank you for staying with us. Until next time, stay safe.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إن مع كل إنسان ملكين يحفظانه فإذا جاء القدر خليا بينه وبينه وإن الأجل جنة حصينة.
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, "With every individual, there are two angels who protect him. When destiny approaches, they let it have its own way with him. Certainly, the appointed time is a protective shield against the events which occur before it."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So one of the great lessons which we learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam is this very interesting and beautiful fact that Imam Ali was the first person who believed in Islam. Now, you might think, well, what is so important about this? Well, first of all, this in itself is something that is a wonderful achievement. It is a proud statement, and it is something incredibly honorable. that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the first person to have believed in Islam, or at least the first man to have believed in Islam, as they say that Lady Khadija was the first woman to believe in Islam. So we find in the commentary of the Holy Quran, the tafsir of the Holy Quran, when it talks about chapter number 9 and verse number 100, the commentator Thalabi talks about this verse. And this verse, again, chapter number 9, verse number 100, says, "And as for the foremost, the first of the Muhajir and the Ansar." Now, not only does Thalabi, but also scholars have unanimously believed that this verse is talking about Imam Ali, and that the first person to have believed in Islam after Lady Khadija was Ali ibn Abi Talib. Abu Dharr and Salman, the great companions, the famous companions, the loyal companions of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him, have been reported as saying, "The Messenger of Allah took Ali's hand in his hand and said, 'This is the first person who believed in me. He is a distinguisher between justice and injustice among the Ummah, the leader of the believers, and the first person who will shake hands with me on the Day of Judgment. He is the greater acceptor of Islam.'" A very beautiful tradition by the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, talking about Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so we learn so many different things here. First and foremost, that Imam Ali is for all Muslims, whether Sunni or Shia. And matter of fact, Imam Ali is a universal persona for those who want to learn about Islam. If we want to learn about Islam, we should go to the sources of Islam. And who a better source for pure Muhammadan Islam than the first person who believed in Islam? The first and foremost and best and most perfect student of the Holy Prophet, Imam Ali alayhi salam. And in the words of the Messenger of Allah, it is Imam Ali who is the distinguisher between justice and injustice. And he is Amir al-Mu'mineen, the leader of the believers. A very beautiful, very profound lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
We invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
And this last will of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Sayyid Razi has included this in the section of Nahj al-Balagha dealing with the letters of Ali, because this was a written document. And this is letter number 47 of Nahj al-Balagha. And so this is Mustanad, as we call it. Authentic last will of Amir al-Mu'mineen, which he wanted it to be not only for his family, but for the entire Shia community, even for those who will come in the future. And then he starts saying things using the words Allah, Allah. You know, I remind you of Allah about this. I remind you of Allah about this. And so this is where he says, Allah, Allah fil aitam. I remind you of Allah regarding the orphans in the community. فَلَا تُغَيِّبُوا أَفْوَاهُهُمْ It shouldn't be that their mouths are empty and they go hungry. وَلَا يُضِيعُوا بِحَضْرَتِكُمْ And they fall in the cracks in your presence. You have to take care of them. وَاللَّهُ وَاللَّهُ فِي جِيرَانِكُمْ I remind you of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala regarding your neighbors. فَإِنَّهُمْ وَصِيَّةُ نَبِيِّكُمْ This is the wasiyyat and the advice of your prophet who used to say so much about neighbors that we thought a time will come, he will say that the neighbors have a share in your estate when you die. And this is what Rasulullah used to say actually, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala recommends so much to be kind and helpful to neighbors that I thought a day will come when Allah will say they even have a share in your miras and your estate after you. Wallah, wallah fil Qur'an. Then Ali reminds us about the Quran. And look at what he says. La yusbiqukum bil amal bihi ghayrukum. It shouldn't be that others go ahead of you in acting on the Quran. It means there is a possibility. Buying a Quran and carrying the Quran is one thing. Living by the Quran is something else. He says, I don't want my people to be the one who own the Qur'an. I want them to be the people who actually live by the Qur'an. And don't give this privilege to others. You have more right to be among the Ahlul Qur'an and the followers of the Qur'an. Wallah, wallah, fi salat. Then he reminds us of salat and the prayers. فَإِنَّهَا عُمُودُ دِينُكُمْ It is the pillar of your faith. Referring to the hadith of the Prophet, where the Prophet says that if our deen in Islam is a tent, that pole in between is the salah.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now. Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The Western Balkans, one of Europe's poorest regions, has for weeks been battling an explosive coronavirus spike, in death toll doubling in the last month alone to reach nearly 10,000. The crisis is exposing gaps in healthcare systems that have long suffered from low funding and a brain drain crisis, with an exodus of promising young doctors and nurses leaving to seek better wages and training abroad. According to the World Health Organization WHO data, even before the pandemic began, the Balkans had some of the lowest density rates of doctors in Europe. Hospitals in the region are now facing further shortages of staff fall victim to the respiratory disease. In Serbia, for example, some 2,000 medical workers have been forced to self-isolate, just as medical wards are seeing a huge inundation of patients filling beds in the capital, Belgrade. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, in North Macedonia and Montenegro are all in Europe's top 10 when it comes to highest per capita death rates on the European continent. We now present you a news report written by staff at Agence France-Presse under the heading Catastrophic, Balkan Healthcare Overwhelmed by Virus Surge. Please stay with us for more of Agence France-Presse's article. Not enough beds and not enough doctors. A skyrocketing coronavirus caseload is pushing hospitals in the Balkans to the cusp of a collapse, in chaotic scenes reminding some medical staff of the region's 1990s wars. After nearly a year of keeping outbreaks more or less under control, the nightmare scenario that the Balkans feared from the start of the pandemic is now starting to unfold. In hard-hit Bosnia-Herzegovina, one doctor described the distress of having to juggle the care of multiple patients whose lives were hanging by a thread. The doctor, who wanted to remain anonymous, told Agence France-Presse, "The situation reminds me of the war, and I'm afraid it could get even worse during the winter." The doctor adding, "We can do the work of three people, but not the work of five." The West Balkans, one of Europe's poorest regions, has for weeks been battling an explosive coronavirus spike, its death toll doubling in the last month alone to reach nearly 10,000. The crisis is exposing gaps in healthcare systems that have long suffered from low funding and a brain drain crisis, with an exodus of promising young doctors and nurses leaving to seek better wages and training abroad. According to the World Health Organization WHO data, even before the coronavirus pandemic began, the Balkans had some of the lowest density rates for doctors in Europe. Hospitals in the Balkans region are now facing further shortages as staff fall victim to the respiratory disease. In Serbia, for example, some 2,000 medical workers have been forced to self-isolate, just as medical wards are seeing a huge inundation of patients, filling beds in the capital, Belgrade. Rade Panic, the president of the Serbian Doctors' Union, told regional television channel N1 recently, "I never had such an experience in my professional career." The anaesthetist, who works in the red zone of a hospital treating the most serious COVID-19 cases, added, "I didn't have room for patients that were medically considered young. I didn't have anywhere to transport them." Bosnia-Herzegovina, North Macedonia and Montenegro are all in Europe's top 10 when it comes to highest per capita death rates on the European continent. Yet governments in the region have been reluctant to return to the drastic lockdowns imposed at the start of the pandemic, instead opting for lighter restrictions such as early closure of restaurants. While Serbia is racing to build two brand new hospitals, Kosovo is considering adapting old hotels into makeshift hospital wards, including the Grand Hotel in downtown Pristina. Overflowing clinics in Pristina mean that some patients, such as 33-year-old Veprim Morina, are being turned away. The fitness instructor told Agence France-Presse, "The doctor told me to take my medication at home since the hospitals are all full." Veprim Morina managed to hire a nurse to provide treatment at home, an option those who can afford it are opting for when possible. He said getting a hospital bed now requires having connections. He added, "You have to be very lucky to find a place in a hospital." In neighbouring North Macedonia, the government is marshalling private clinics and their staff to treat COVID-19 patients after public hospitals hit full capacity. North Macedonia's health minister, Venko Filipce, said, "We have been providing new beds, but it is harder and harder." Outside clinics in the capital Skopje, relatives of patients bring food and sometimes even medicine to their loved ones. One man seeking information on his sick relative said, "Catastrophic, unorganized, no one answers the phone for hours," adding, "The medical staff are fighting, giving their best, but they simply cannot do everything." Croatia's doctors have also warned of staff and equipment shortages in Croatia's hospitals. They say more than 2,500 patients are currently hospitalized, and 3,000 would push the healthcare system to the edge of collapse. Experts say politicians have struggled to strike a balance between controlling the virus and protecting fragile economies. Croatian economist Ljubo Jurčić said, "We are too poor that all lockdown measures be repeated twice." In Bosnia-Herzegovina, shops, restaurants and gymnasiums all remain open, while Serbia recently cut hours for businesses, but has stopped short of an all-out closure. While progress on vaccines is helping doctors hope, they fear the chaos that would unfold in the meantime. Jasmina Smajic, a doctor in the Bosnian city of Tuzla, said, "I don't understand why the authorities don't put in place more restrictive measures," she added. "Something must be done about this if we want to prevent a catastrophic consequences." Meanwhile, a World Health Organization WHO special COVID-19 envoy has predicted a third wave of the pandemic in Europe in early 2021. If European governments repeat what he said was a failure to do what was needed to prevent the second wave of infections. The World Health Organization's David Nabarro said in an interview with Swiss newspaper, "They missed building up the necessary infrastructure during the summer months, after they brought the first wave under control." David Nabarro, a British citizen who campaigned unsuccessfully to become the director of the World Health Organization in 2017, said, "Now we have the second wave of coronavirus. If they don't build the necessary infrastructure, we'll have a third wave early next year." Europe briefly enjoyed sinking infection rates that are now surging again. Germany and France on Saturday saw cases rise by about 40,000 combined. Switzerland and Austria have thousands of cases daily, whilst Turkey reported a record 6,000 new infections. David Nabarro singled out Switzerland's move to allow skiing, with wearing face masks required in gondolas, as other Alpine nations like Austria have shuttered ski resorts. David Nabarro said Switzerland could reach a very high level of sickness and deaths. Nabarro was quoted by the newspaper Solothurner Zeitung as saying, "Once the infection rates sink, and they will sink, then we can be as free as we want," he added. "But right now, should ski resorts be open? Under what conditions?" David Nabarro lauded the response of Asian countries like China and South Korea, where infections are now relatively low. "People are fully engaged. They take on behaviors that make it difficult for the virus to transmit. They keep their distance, they wear face masks, they isolate when they're sick, they wash their hands and surfaces. They protect the most endangered groups." David Nabarro also said Asia did not relax restrictions permanently and prematurely. He said, "You must wait until case numbers are low and stay low." He added, "Europe's reaction was incomplete."
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech.
the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Javdan. Please stay tuned. Satan on the Day of Judgment claims to be only a motive for the commitments of sins. He claims to do this through his control over our sense of imagination. Now, in order to stop Satan from deceiving us, we have to get control of our imagination and power of thinking. This is difficult, but possible through controlling our eyes, ears, and tongue. If we want to be free from satanic temptations, we have to control our imagination, because this is the only way that Satan will enter in order to deceive us. In better words, it is good to be the main controller of our soul and mind. In this way, we have to be more careful about what we say, hear, or see, even if we are on our way to home or workplace, in a taxi or in a car. Such conscious attitude towards the sins around us will help us to find mastery over our imagination and not be trapped by the Satan easily. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Javdan. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.